Hello, everyone. My name is Amber Ray, and I am here with Derek Sivers, a professional musician who turned his hobby for helping people and his friends sell their CDs online into a $100 million business. As part of the Domino Project of the last few months, I've had the pleasure to work with Derek on the launch of his new book, Anything You Want, 40 Lessons for a New Kind of Entrepreneur. So hello, Derek. It's such a pleasure to be talking with you today.
Hello.
So why Derek's book is so special is because it's unlike any business book that I've ever read, probably because it's not just about business. It's about following your passion and doing the things that make you happy. And so today we're going to dive into some of Derek's inspiring philosophies and his experience starting and selling his business, CD Baby. Ready to get started, Derek?
Sure.
So you lead with a compass. You know why you do what you do, and your purpose and your values are extremely important to your being. You believe that business is not about just making money. It's about making dreams come true for others and for yourself. How did you come to obtain this belief system?
I think anytime you're setting out to do something, most of us have been through a stage in our life where we're doing something for the money and we're miserable, or we're doing something that we thought we should be enjoying and then we get miserable doing it, or that awful feeling where you're just kind of feeling vaguely dissatisfied and you don't know why. So maybe it's just because I did that stuff for 10 or 15 years, long before I started CD Baby. I kind of went through all those different stages and pursuing something that I thought was my dream, and then I got there and I went, eh. So maybe I just realized that that unless you know why you're doing what you're doing and you're doing it in a way that actually makes you happy, that's what's really important. If you're not doing that, then it's kind of moot and empty. So I guess I learned it the hard way through trial and error. And I guess it also has to do with the fact that CD Baby was never really meant to be a business. It was this silly little hobby that I started to help my friends, and then it grew from that. So I felt that I was kind of honoring the initial intention of it by making it this thing that helped my friends instead of just me.
Gotcha. And so more than anyone I've ever met, you're sincerely driven to help people. I mean, everything, again, you accidentally started your business because you wanted to help your friends. Why?
This is actually, it was from Seth Godin that I got this great line when one time I was telling him about, there was a time a year or two ago when I was feeling in this kind of, not really a funk, but I was just kind of coasting for a while. I was just on the sabbatical, and I told him how I went off to the TED conference and was having these conversations with people, and I felt that I didn't have much to add. And he said, well, you don't want to be spreading ennui. And I had to go look up the word ennui. I forget the exact definition. But it was something kind of like a blasé disinterest or something like that. And in further conversations with Seth, he would say things like, you know, you got to be doing something useful with your life. You can't just hang out and play video games. What's the point of existing then?
Right.
Not that I was playing video games, you know what I mean, but just as an example. And I guess that's kind of how I'd been feeling for a long time anyway, is that any of us could do something that makes some money but feels empty, you know, like say if you're working at a bank somewhere and you're moving digits around, but it's not really doing anything for anybody. It's not really benefiting you or your customers or anything. But the feeling when you can actually see that you're helping people,
mm-hmm.
I mean, like getting an immediate response, like you do something for somebody and they go, oh my God, thank you. Wow. What a difference. It's such an amazing feeling that it's just like that equals, like that's your real payment. You know what I mean? So there's another great example. A friend of mine, he was actually my old college roommate. He went on to be an engineer. I think he was like a kind of construction engineer, something like that for 10 or 15 years. I lost track of him for a while. And just a couple of years ago, I ran into him, and I said, Matt, what's going on? Fill me in. And he said, well, after 10 years, I quit my job as an engineer, because it's like every day, even though I was only working 9 to 5, I would go home at like 5:30, exhausted.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I was just hating my life. And he said, I quit, and I went to nursing school at the age of 34. And he said, I love it. I've never been happier. He said, it took a few years, but now I'm official nurse, and he said, every day I help somebody in some real concrete, like they were in pain and now they're not in pain kind of way. He said, I don't go home tired anymore. He said, I'm probably working like 10 or 12 hours, but I go home psyched and feeling good. So that was kind of a more concrete way of putting it. But there's just, it's such a better feeling when something you're doing is actually useful to people instead of just making you money.
Definitely, definitely. So we all have a lot of ideas and projects. How do you know what's a hit and what's a miss?
Ooh. I think it's, you gauge the response of people. And this one took me a long time to figure out. That if you just go asking, say you've got some business idea, and you tell people like, hey, I'm thinking of starting an online dog washing service. And you tell your friends and they go, yeah, wow, cool. Well, let me know when it's happening. If you're not paying attention, you'd think that you just got a great response. You'd think, hey, my friends seem to like it. They said to let them know when it happens. Woohoo, I'm going to do it. But it isn't until you get this kind of reaction where people say, like, oh my God, I need that. Like, can I be your first? Can I pay you right now? Can I give you some money now so I can be your very first customer? Because I need that so bad. And when you get that kind of reaction, then you're really onto something. So again, I kind of found this out the hard way when I decided to sell CD Baby, and I went on to launch all of the other things that I've been wanting to do for 10 years of running CD Baby. I didn't have the time to do anything else. So when I sold CD Baby, on my personal website, I put my like six projects that I had always wanted to do. I put all of them on my front page. I said, Derek Sivers' homepage, here's my projects. Click into any single one of them that interests you. And, for example, one of them was I wanted to do a documentary about the inside of the grassroots music business. So I wanted to like take a video camera and go into nightclubs and booking agents and publicists' offices and show musicians what it's like to be on the receiving end of their music and talk to those people that musicians are often sending their music to ask them about their job and what's the hardest part and what they would recommend and stuff like that. I thought this was a brilliant idea. I was so into this. And I would tell people about it and they'd go, yeah, cool. Yeah, that sounds cool. Let me know when that's happening. Okay, so for example, that was one of them. But then I had this other one called Muckwork that I'll skip the details, but it's basically like, you know, an assistant service for musicians. Like, give us your stuff that you don't want to do and we'll do that stuff. We'll have these assistants that are trying to do that. And every time I would tell people about this, they would go, oh my God, I need that. What, is it ready yet? Can I sign up right now? Can I give you money now? And often I find these things like 2 days after I told somebody about it, say just over dinner or something, they'd call me a couple days later saying, hey, so that Muckwork thing, is that, can I start using that yet? Like, can I, how can I get in on it? I need that. Like, I really, I've been thinking about it and I want to do it. So that's when I got the feeling that I was really onto something with Muckwork and decided to let go of the other five. So I'm telling this story not to like talk about me or my new project or who cares, but I think like whatever you're doing, look for that kind of reaction where people are so psyched about it that they're kind of, you know, they've got that oh my God kind of response, and especially if you're doing something that people are willing to pay for, not just like, hey, yeah, that'd be nice if you hand it to me for free on a silver platter. But if they're actually willing to pay for it, then you know you're onto something. If not, my best advice is to just keep inventing and adjusting your plan to do something different instead of trying to, you know, persistently knock on all the doors with that idea that people don't seem very into.
Makes sense. So how about when we, you know, take on too much and then we become really busy? Then how do you determine what's worth doing?
Can we swear in this interview? No, I'll use a PG-13 word, but replace my PG-13 word with the cuss word of your choice, and you'll have my real philosophy here. But I have this philosophy called "Hell yeah or no," and what it means is that whenever you've got all these options to do something, like somebody says, hey, do you want to come to this conference? Do you want to go to this party? Hey, can you come work at my bakery next Saturday? Hey, do you want to do this and that? And oftentimes we say yes to everything with the best of intentions. California people especially are notorious for this, being so optimistic that you say yes to everything. And you think, yeah, I can do that. Cool. I'll be there. I'll come to your gig. I'll do this. I'll buy your book. I'll read it. I'll let you know what I think. I'll be at that party. I'll show up to this event. I'll help you wash your dog next week. We have the best of intentions when we say it, but unfortunately, like, as it gets closer, then you start feeling like, oh God, why did I say I would do that? Like, I'm not into it. I don't really want to do this thing, but I have to. So my new filter that I made is that I realize, like, we all say yes to too many things, and the way to narrow it down is if you're feeling like really like, hell yeah, I want to do that, then you do it. But if you're feeling anything less than that, like if you're just feeling like, yeah, I could, maybe I should, I owe them a favor, I'll do it. But no, I just say all that stuff, just say no to all of it, and only say yes to the stuff that you're actually feeling like hell yeah to. Mm-hmm. Because if you say no to almost everything, it's a really hard thing to do, to say no so much. But imagine everything that comes into your life, if you're not feeling like absolutely like, hell yeah, that would be awesome, then just say no. And all of a sudden you have all this space in your life. You have free time because you've learned to say no to things. What's cool is that when you have that much space in your life, then you're ready for more hell yeah type things to enter your life. Then you'll actually have the time to give them when those few rare occasional things show up.
Got it. I love that. How do you say no? That's always the challenge that I have.
It's funny, you know, there's these different calls. I asked Seth that, and he said, just say no. Just no. No. Just no. I was like, damn it, I can't do that. You know, I'm living in Singapore now. There's this whole kind of like Asian, there's a different way to say no here. There's a lot of kind of saving face. Bluntness is not a virtue. Really, I just kind of, honestly, I just use some manners. And I'm very sincere when I say something like, I would love to, but I'm really committed to work on something I'm working on right now, and so I can't. I honestly would really enjoy sitting around for hours and talking with you about life and love and happiness and whatnot, but I really need to work on this project. I'm sorry. Like, definitely at some point in the future, I would love to. That might be days, weeks, months, years, I don't know, but let's keep in touch and hopefully someday, you know. So I kind of have my soft no like that. That's a clear no.
Yep.
I don't do, the worst thing to do is you don't do that thing where you say, oh yeah, maybe I'll be there, and then you don't. That's just right. Like, come on, have the guts to say no. If it's almost rude to give a maybe if you mean no, but instead you just kind of find a soft but real way to say no.
Good, very helpful.
Look, this is like Dear Abby. Does she still exist?
I don't know. So let's get into CD Baby a little bit. So you accidentally started it because it was a favorite of friends. You wanted to sell your and your friend's CDs online, but there was no business that did this yet. How hard was it actually setting up the online store, and how did you feel when you were going through that process?
Wasn't that hard in hindsight. I mean, it was hard for me because I didn't know any programming skills or whatever. So I really just had like a static HTML site. It took about 3 months of paperwork to get a credit card merchant account. Because I set up CD Baby before there was PayPal, before there was Amazon. And, well, Amazon was just a bookstore, and PayPal didn't exist yet. And so that was the environment when I set up CD Baby, like the end of 1997. And so to get a credit card merchant account, you had to go apply through a bank, and it was like 3 months of paperwork. They actually had to send an inspector out to my location to make sure I was a valid business. I had to incorporate. I had to set up a business account. I had to do all this stuff, and after 3 months and $1,000 in setup fees, I had a credit card account, and I could charge people's credit cards. So I set up this site just to sell my CD. But after I did, a couple of my musician friends in New York City kind of said, "Whoa, dude, can you sell my CD through that thing?" Mm-hmm. I said, "Yeah, sure, okay." So it was really just like as a favor to friends on my. It wasn't even a separate store; it was just on my band's website. It was like, "Click here to buy my CD." And a big buy now button. And below it, it said, or some of my friends. And I had their CDs down there. But then I started getting these calls like, hey man, my friend Dave said you could sell my CD. And I was like, oh, sure, if you're a friend of Dave's, no problem. But I was doing it all for free as a favor. Mm-hmm. But after I'd hooked up about 20 friends of friends for free as a favor, I realized I had to start charging money for it. So
yep.
I took those 20 friends, took them off of my band's website, put it on cdbaby.com, and that was my stupid little hobby.
Love it. Stupid little hobby that turned into a $100 million business.
Yeah, oops.
So you believe that starting with no money is actually an advantage. Well, I wholeheartedly agree. You know, how do you take care of the necessities, and was money ever an issue or a concern for you?
Now, I think there's a way of doing something that I call it like version 0.1, which is often people have these business ideas, right? They say, I want to make the most ultimate music recommendation service. It's going to do the back-end music recommendations for every business on the internet and the whole world, and it's all going to go through me, and it's going to bring in your friends and your concert calendars and this and events in your area, and pictures of your friends' pets will appear in your fridge when you drink. Okay, anyway. So people often have these giant ideas. But I kind of think like that's everything it will be someday.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like software has version numbers, right? You know, like version 1, 2, 3.0, 3.5. So I say what you just described is version infinity. That's everything it will ever be someday.
Mm-hmm.
But now let's go back to version 0.1. Version 0.1 is the thing that you can just start right now with no money. It doesn't cost anything. It's kind of just a proof of concept to say you could do it. Say you did it, you can just make one person happy. Like if you can satisfy one person, and especially if you can do something that makes that one person pay you to do it,
mm-hmm.
then you're onto something, and you don't need fancy systems to do it. So, for example, we all know OpenTable, right? Most people know what OpenTable is, restaurant reservations online. I met this guy in India who said that OpenTable doesn't work with India right now, and he wanted to do OpenTable in India. And he said, but the tough thing is, you know, we're trying to develop all this software, and then we've got to go to every restaurant in India and get them to use our software for the reservation management, all this kind of stuff. It's going to take so much work. And I said, well, hold on. What if you just right now set up a simple little page with a phone number on your site, and you send somebody around on a scooter to all the little restaurants in India, got their phone number and got their menu, and you just go home, like basically type in the menu onto your website, and if somebody wants to book a reservation, they just call you. Then you get their info. Then you hang up the phone and you call the restaurant. You make the reservation for them. There you go. No software needed. It's just like two phone calls and it works. And some scooters, and you can start that with no software this week. So that to me is like a version 0.1 proof of concept, right? Yes. So I think that sometimes when entrepreneurs get too focused on raising money, getting venture capital, and then perhaps they get it. I think this is more of like a first dot-com boom thing, mm-hmm. you know, like when people were all of a sudden just given $20 million because they had a silly idea. It's not happening as much anymore, but I found that especially back then it was really harmful because once you get too much money, you start doing really stupid things that make you forget the whole point of actually helping people.
Yep.
Helping people doesn't really cost money.
I love that. That's great. I think it might be kind of happening again here in New York, but I don't know.
Yeah.
We'll see how it goes.
We'll look back at this interview, you know, a few years from now and see if we can laugh about a bubble or not. Yeah,
definitely. So you definitely have an unconventional approach to business. How do you feel about corporate formalities like privacy policies, employee review plans, and things like that?
How do you think I feel about them? Oh, I love them. I love corporate policies. I want policies and legalese everywhere. Before I enter the bed at night, I read my wife some legalese. I tell her our privacy policy for the bedroom. No, you know, I have this... I think people try to make business a lot more complicated than it needs to be. And you know what I love remembering is that if you've ever been to a beach, and if near the beach there was one of those places that will rent you a snorkel and fins and or sell you a drink, you know, you didn't see a posted terms and conditions and a privacy policy at that place, and you didn't see giant legalese, and you didn't have to sign your life away. You just, you know, you hand the guy $10 and you get some fins and you go in the water and bring them back. And I would always tell people, CD Baby, it's like business. I mean, look, that's a valid business on the beach renting you flippers for $10. Like, mm-hmm. doesn't need to be more complicated than that. And I think all that other stuff, people kind of try to fill themselves full of, especially, you know, those legal disclaimers at the bottom of every email. There's like a giant paragraph of legalese basically saying you are not allowed to read the email I'm sending you. People get fearful and they think that all this legalese is going to somehow protect them. But mm-hmm. yeah, just look at so many examples of businesses in the world that don't need that and you don't need it. And I just think that if you wouldn't do that to your friends, why do you treat your customers like enemies? You know, it's like if you treat your customers like friends, they almost every time will treat you like friends. And in that rare occasional case where somebody screws up or screws you, then, oh, well, that's just kind of the cost of doing business. And you fit it into things that 1% of the people are going to screw you. So, oh, well, you know?
Yep.
You know, I think there's such a thing as like overprotecting, trying to protect against every possible thing and make it worse for everybody. It's like punishing everyone just because if one person might mess up.
I like that. That makes sense. So then what about advertising?
I've got a personal bias against advertising. I'm one of those freaks that I don't have a TV. On my laptop, I put in all that ad blocking kind of stuff, so I just never see ads. I don't listen to regular FM radio. I only listen to internet radio. And then even then, I pay the $20 a year, so I don't ever have to hear advertising. And so I've got a pretty advertising-free life. And so ads just kind of offend me. It's just so whenever somebody's talking about a site that's advertising driven or what I want to put advertising on my site. Of course, I've just got a personal bias against it. But one thing I used to do to just to screw with friends is when they would show me their website. See, it's like somebody's sitting over my shoulder saying, hey, check out my new site. What do you think? And if I go to their site and there's, you know, a banner ad or something on top, I just click it immediately and it takes me away. And they're like, hey, what are you doing? I'm like, oh, you wanted me to leave? And like, no, I didn't want you. I was like, well, why'd you put that thing on top if you didn't want me to click it? So, yeah, I'm going to check out some Sony headphones now. We froze for a second.
Yeah,
sorry.
Okay. We're back.
It's the advertising police. They heard him speaking out again.
Now you're frozen again, but.
I have it.
Oh no, come back. Okay.
No, advertising is good. Yes, advertising is good. We're back. I like it.
I think that happened for a reason. Okay. So for the first year or so, I think it was only you and two employees, right?
Mm-hmm.
So how did you...
The first year was just me.
Okay.
Second year was me and one guy, and then by the end of the second year, we got a second person. It grew from there.
Okay, and how did you feel when it started to grow, and how did you go about hiring people?
Growth was always reluctant. Meaning, I was making my living as a professional musician, right? So I was already kind of living my musician's dream. Like, I was making a living, and I bought my house with the money I made just playing music. It was a dream come true. So as CD Baby was growing, I was kind of thinking, I don't want this little hobby to take over my music life. I almost mentioned advertising again. So I was growing very reluctantly. So I'd only hire another person if I absolutely had to, if I had so much work that I just couldn't handle it anymore. So the first guy I hired, John, was the guy that happened to be painting my apartment. And I kind of said, hey, man, you looking for some extra work? And he said, sure. I said, can you help me pack up some CDs a couple hours a day? And he said, sure. So that was John, and he went on to be the vice president of the company.
Amazing.
And then when we needed to hire, I just asked John if he knew anybody that needed some work. And he said, yeah, I know this guy, Tynan. I said, is he good? He said, yeah, he's a cool guy. I said, all right, tell him to start tomorrow. Same thing. Then every time we needed to hire, we just asked the existing people that work there, like, hey, who has any friend that needs work? Somebody would say, hey, I've got this guy named Ben, friend of mine. Is he cool? Yeah, he's cool. All right, tell him to start tomorrow. So it's a wonderful way to hire, because then everybody's friends of friends. You've got this kind of peer, what do you call it, like responsibility to your peers,
mm-hmm.
that you're going to screw your friends over if they recommended you. And it really made for a good kind of happy family, at least for the first 8 years or so.
Gotcha. And I love how that just so naturally fell into place. Nothing was forced about it.
Yeah, me too.
So in 2003, so 5 years into growing CD Baby, Steve Jobs disses you in a keynote. Tell me about that experience and how you felt when you were going through it.
All right. This will be interesting to see if my picture freezes up again when I speak against the man. Yeah, we got this in 2003. CD Baby was rolling along quite well, and got this email from Apple asking us to come up to their office and talk about getting the CD Baby catalog into the iTunes Music Store. So at that point, the iTunes Music Store was really only a few weeks old. It had just launched. A lot of people thought it wasn't going to do well. They're kind of doubtful, because other companies like eMusic had done that exact same model, trying to sell 99-cent downloads, and failed. So we went up to the Apple's office, to a little room with just 100 people in it, and kind of thought that I was going to be talking with a marketing guy or whatever, but Steve Jobs himself walks out.
Wow.
In full presentation. Yeah, I was like, whoa, rock star. So in full presentation mode, he's saying how he wants to get everybody's music up and selling in the iTunes Music Store, our whole catalog, everything. He said, even if it's discontinued, we want everything available. I said, great. And so they gave us all the contract that day, and took it back that night, signed the contract, sent it back to Apple, and didn't hear anything. So the next day, I had been taking notes on this whole meeting at the Apple campus, and I posted my notes on the cdbaby.org kind of bulletin board site, and I emailed it to all the musicians, because I said, hey, went to this meeting at Apple yesterday. Apple really wants to get everybody's music up and selling in the store. Here's my notes from the meeting. Just thought you guys should know we're going to be putting something together and we're going to do this. So I posted that, went to sleep that night, and in the morning I woke up and Apple's lawyers were on the phone just like, what are you nuts? That was a private meeting. That was a non-disclosure, whatever. I said, hey, I honestly didn't know. I didn't sign anything saying I wouldn't share it. Like, if I would have signed something, I would have known that it was secret, but I honestly didn't know it was secret. But
corporate legalese.
Well, so to respect our relationship, I immediately pulled the notes down. But I noticed that whereas Apple told us that they were ready to begin, at first, nobody was returning our contract.
Hmm.
And I thought, oh no, I pissed them off because I posted the notes of the meeting and now they're letting me have it and they're punishing me. And all these little conspiracy theories, because I just had no idea why they weren't getting back to us, and I tried to call them and they wouldn't tell us. So after 2 or 3 months, by the way, it's helpful, Brent. Set up a system where we digitize everybody's CD. It involved all this work, right? So in order to send somebody's CD to Apple, we had to actually go out into the warehouse, pull the CD off the shelf, stick it into a Mac using their software, redigitize the whole thing using Apple's encoding software, type in all the song titles and everything all over again. So it was a lot of work per album.
Wow.
Sorry. It was a lot of work per album, so I set a $40 processing fee per album, right? So the only reason this is important is that when Steve Jobs, when we just weren't hearing anything back from Apple, Steve Jobs did a kind of Apple, one of those events that's simulcast.
Mm-hmm.
And he went on stage and said something about, do you know that there are these companies out there that are promising just anyone that they can get their music up on iTunes? Well, we don't. Oh, and he said, charging $40 to anybody's music up onto iTunes. Well, we don't want that stuff here. We believe that the major labels give us a good quality filtered product, and we only want the best stuff here.
Hmm.
It's just my heart just sank. Cause I was like, oh, God. He said $40. That's me. There's nobody else, you know?
Right.
So, I felt personally dissed. And so that night I sent an email to all my musicians saying, sorry, change of plans. Apple doesn't want anybody's music unless they're on a major label. So never mind. And I refunded everybody's $40. I sent it all back. It was like $200,000 I refunded. And then the very next day, we get a signed contract back from Apple saying, great, start uploading the music now. So anyway.
Huh. How, do you know why? Like, how did that...
Never found out why, even years later, talked to people that used to work at Apple, and they said, it's a mysterious black box there.
Interesting.
Yeah, as we're talking on a Linux laptop with my Android phone. My friends every now and then say, why don't you use a Mac? I say, I'll tell you later.
That's funny. So one thing that you really recommend is making yourself unnecessary to the running of your business. How do you delegate while still making sure that the business runs smoothly?
I think that entrepreneurs have this tendency to micromanage and try to do everything themselves. You know, you started a company, it's very tied up with your personal passion and ambition and often your personal identity. Everybody knows it's your company.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really hard to let go. First, the psychological barrier to get over that I highly recommend for anybody is this feeling that letting somebody else do what you used to do probably, maybe, they won't do it as good as you,
mm-hmm.
but you just have to have the sense of good enough to kind of say, like, okay, technically, if I did it, maybe I could do it a little bit better, but you know what? Relax, exhale, good enough. Because you just have to realize that if you try to get in there and do everything yourself, you're holding back your business. Like, it can never grow beyond a certain point if you're trying to do everything yourself.
Right.
So you have to let other people help you, and then you just have to have a sense of good enough. And then if you're lucky, this is what really impresses me about the whole Domino team, honestly, is that if you find amazing people that can do things actually better than you could do it yourself, then it's an awesome feeling. So, of course, you keep working to try to find people that are even better than you, say like customer service, people that are more patient than you or more friendly than you on the phone, or, you know, financial-wise, people that have more of a sense of numbers than you do. Hopefully, eventually, you'll get your team to that point. But even if you're just starting, if you have people helping you, they're just good enough. That's a big one. That's a huge psychological barrier to get past, is the sense of good enough. But then the next thing is documenting. There's this thing of every time something is on your shoulders, if somebody's saying, like, if there's something that's still your responsibility, document everything you're doing, even trying to document your thought process.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how do you reply to emails? What is your thought process? Like, if a certain person asks this kind of question, you say that. If they're asking you to go to coffee tomorrow so they can pick your brain for 3 hours, how do you say no?
Mm-hmm.
If you start to document all this so that you could show it to somebody else, and eventually you'll set it so that somebody else is doing it, and then you even ask them to document all the things that they're doing. So I just think that, like, this kind of constant documentation, the goal being that you could actually have a handbook that says how to do what you do. It's almost like a cookbook, right? Like a recipe for how you make your decisions. A lot of it's the philosophies,
mm-hmm.
you know? So it's sharing not just the exact, like, how do you respond to this question with this answer, but instead it's like trying to communicate the philosophy behind how you came up with that so that eventually the person doing it without you understands your philosophy and can have the autonomy
mm-hmm.
to do everything themselves, you know, understanding the mission. You know what I mean?
So instead of just what to do, how to go about thinking what you do. The thought process that goes behind just the action.
Yeah.
I like that.
It's hard. I mean, learning to delegate is one of the hardest things a small business or startup entrepreneur can do. It's really difficult, but it's so worth it because you just can't grow without it.
Right. Noted. So you sold your company to charity for $22 million. How did you know you were done with CD Baby, and why did you decide to give the company to charity?
Okay.
Deep breath.
So, yeah, wait, what was that? How and why? What I forgot.
How did you decide, or how did you know you were done with CD Baby? And then why did you decide to give it the proceeds to charity?
Okay. All right. 2 points. So how I knew I was done with CD Baby, that was really tough. I really thought I was going to do CD Baby for the rest of my life. In fact, there was a kind of National Public Radio did an article about CD Baby, or a little show about us. And I said in that show, like, I'm never selling the company. Because, of course, that was people's question often is, yeah, when are you going to sell out? I said, no, I'm never going to sell out. I didn't get into this for the money. I'm not going to get out of it for the money. I'm just going to keep doing this till I die. And I sincerely meant it. But then after 10 years, it started to feel a little bit like I had nothing more to add. And metaphorically, it's a little bit like, imagine some painter or sculptor that is working on one of those giant murals, you know, that takes up a whole wall that that takes years to do. And I'm sure at a certain point, they put this last brushstroke on it, and they're just looking at it, and they're just like, yeah, it's done. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of how I was feeling about CD Baby. Like, everything I set out to do, I had done. I had no vision left for it. I actually didn't want to add anything new to it. I didn't want to change anything. It just felt like I'm done. I didn't want it to be bigger. I didn't want it to grow. And it was actually Seth encouraged me. I kind of call him, he's been like an occasional mentor to me. Mm-hmm. I get to ask him questions and he replies. And when I told him about my predicament, that I was kind of feeling like a little bit done and I didn't want the business to grow, he said, you know, if you care, you need to sell. Like, mm-hmm. The point was, like, if you care about your clients, if you care about your customers, you need to sell, because the way you're feeling, you're actually doing your customers a disservice, because the musician clients, they want your business to grow. They want their own careers to grow. And if you don't want to grow, then you're actually doing them a disservice. So you should sell it to somebody else who wants it to grow. And that really helped make my decision to sell. But mostly it was just that artistic sense of just feeling done. So I'd always had companies calling asking to buy CD Baby, and I'd always said no. So in January 2008, as usual, I had a company call and ask if I wanted to sell. I said, nope, I'm never selling. Goodbye. And then just like 2 days later, another company called out of the blue and said, hey, we're wondering if you're interested in selling CD Baby. And I said, nope, not interested at all. Goodbye. And then 2 days later, I had a third company call all in 1 week.
Wow.
Asking if I wanted to sell. And I told the third one no, but then it was like that weekend I had some soul-searching time, and I realized, like, okay, take a hint. I'm feeling done. Seth said I should sell, and I got 3 calls in 1 week.
Right.
I think I should take a hint. Like, this is a seller's market. This is a good time to go. Mm-hmm. So, I did the thing that I thought I would never do. I told all 3 companies that I'd be willing to sell. I let them bid against each other, and chose the company that didn't have the top bid, but I felt they knew my customers the best and my musicians would be in the best hands. So this company called Disc Makers that I've been working with for years, and they're good. So so I had this agreed upon price of $22 million. I was like, $22 million? What the hell do you do with $22 million? So on to Amber's next question, which is like, what was it again? Like, kind of, why did you decide to
give the company to charity? At that $22 million.
So after, there was about 8 months of time in between the agreement to sell and like when all the paperwork was done. So I had 8 months to kind of think about life and what I wanted to do with $22 million. So just to give some perspective, CD Baby had already been making a few million dollars a year net profit for the last few years. So I already had enough. I had paid off my mortgage. Mm-hmm. You know, I was not in debt. So I had more than enough already. So I was thinking about $22 million and I realized that I didn't even want it. Like, there was nothing I was going to do with it. In fact, I was probably just going to give it all to charity when I die. So I mentioned this to my accountant that I was talking with anyway, because of the sale of the company, we were talking often. And I said, you know, I don't even want the money. In fact, I would feel better if it wasn't in my hands. I don't want to be one of those people that goes into something, a boat I hate that.
He froze for a second.
So I said, I really want all to go to charity when I die. Oh, sorry. I want it all to go to charity when I die. But while I'm alive, I'd like it to be there just kind of like a nest egg, just to know that I won't have to, like, get a job at Walmart someday. You know, to know that I'm, not that I guess Walmart, but just to know that it's like, that I'll be comfortable while I'm alive.
Mm-hmm.
So he told me that there's this thing called a charitable remainder unit trust that is, I love how it freezes my face in these weird faces. There's this thing called a charitable trust that you can set up where it does just that. So it's like I can donate it all now and it's gone. It's irreversibly gone to charity. But while I'm alive, I get like a little kind of almost like a salary just to pay all my living expenses and whatnot. So, yeah, that's what I did. And it just I realized it made me happier. I like feeling kind of lightweight. I was happier not to have $22 million sitting in my bank account. That would just feel weird. And I like the idea that it's all going to go to charity when I die. So the whole idea is like while I'm alive, my actions get to be as helpful as possible. Like I can try to continue to be as helpful as possible when I'm alive. Frozen a funny face again. And then when I die, then the money gets to be helpful in my place. So that was the idea.
Very admirable.
But you know, see, the thing is, like, it wasn't that altruistic. It's like I'm already quite comfortable. It's not like I'm, you know, living in a shack or something because I gave it all away. It's like I'm doing fine, but it just, I actually did it just because it made me happier. That wasn't even trying to be, you know, altruistic or charitable or admirable or anything. It was just like, again, it's like that compass you got to pay attention to. Like, what, of all the different options you have, which one makes you say, hell yeah? Like, what makes you the happiest? It's like, when I just looked at all my different options, it's like, yeah, that would be really nice. I'd like that. I don't want to have $22 million. So, anyway.
So then, which was better, starting your company, selling it, or selling it, and why?
Starting. Yeah, selling is icky. Selling is weird. It's a little bit like graduating and getting a divorce at the same time.
Hmm.
It's a lot of emotions tied up in that and a lot of paperwork, as a divorce is. So starting a company is really cool and exciting. And I think most people, I mean, hell, if you read the autobiographies of anybody, whether it's Howard Schultz with Starbucks or Richard Branson or Dell or whatever, they often talk about those early days with kind of a twinkle in their eye, like, oh, wow, that was so fun. And it is. So I think in the future, I think I'd like to start more companies and probably sell them earlier. Like I wasn't happy the last few years of CD Baby when it was big. I think everybody has their natural set point they like, right? So apparently somebody like Bill Gates, when his company was, whatever, $500 billion, he felt extremely inspired. He wanted to be bigger, right?
Mm-hmm.
Richard Branson, top of whatever. Some people, like, they just, they see they're like, they want to be and on the other hand, you've seen some people, like the notorious lottery winners, who their set point is down here. Like if you give them $1 million, they spend it all immediately so that they're back to nothing.
Right.
So I think my set point was somewhere about here. That I don't want to be too, I didn't want to be too big. I didn't like having 85 employees. I was really happy with like 10 to 20. Mm-hmm. That was a really good size. After about 20, wasn't as happy. So I think I can use that knowledge for the future to just like, I'll do things from here to there. But after a certain point, I think it's good if somebody else takes it from there.
Gotcha. So speaking of starting things and potentially selling them earlier, you're living full time in Singapore now. What's next for you?
Yeah. Let's see. What's next for me is a peanut butter and jelly sandwich after this phone call. I mean, I'm starting another company, but I'm feeling Kind of living more in the moment. Like right now, I'm learning Chinese a few hours a day and just absolutely loving it. I'm relearning the Ruby programming language. A lot of what I'm doing feels like putting myself through school, except instead of going to a university, I'm kind of doing it all myself. But I really spend like hours a day just studying, learning, and reading a lot, writing a lot. So I love that. But yeah, I'm starting another company or two or three to help musicians, and we'll see which ones people seem to like the best. And I would talk about it, but you know, honestly, I have this core philosophy that nobody knows the future, and I wish people would stop pretending like they do, because they don't. And I think it's wiser to just admit that you don't know. So even if I were to talk about my new company that I'm doing, I know it's going to turn out different than I expect, as everything does. So it's kind of like, why talk about it? So if you want to check out my site as it goes, you'll see how it progresses and changes.
I can't wait to see what you come up with. So your book, Anything You Want, comes out, what month are we in? It comes out June 29th. What are three takeaways that people should take from the book?
I think a big one is paying close attention to the compass in your gut that says like what excites you and what drains you, and pay really close attention to what makes you happy, because it's often not the thing that you thought would make you happy. I think sometimes we end up like getting a little dream in our heads when we're teenagers, and we pursue it, and then we get there, and you go, ugh. In fact, those years that I worked at Warner Brothers in New York City for a few years in their kind of music, and I met so many miserable rock stars that had gotten to the pinnacle of their teenage dreams. They were the rock star that they always dreamed they should be, and they were just miserable, and you just felt bad, like, God, you really... You got to get out of this. Do something else because you're not happy.
Right.
Pay close attention to what makes you happy, because it's often not what you expected. So that's a big takeaway. Let's see. Number two is this thing that I call uncommon sense, that often the best things that you could be doing for people, whether as a business or just as a favor, are often the things that aren't radical or revolutionary. They just kind of, they make common sense. But sometimes it's shocking how a lot of other businesses out there aren't doing the obviously helpful thing. They make things more complicated than they need to be, or don't see the obvious straight path and try to fill it with lots of hurdles. And if you find a simpler way to help people, it just feels like uncommon sense. So that's a big one. And I don't know, what's number three? Can you give me a hint? What did you, come on, Amber Ray. What's something that stuck with you?
You say when you're starting a business, it's really when you're creating your own utopia. And so kind of what you did with CD Baby is you painted your ideal and potentially unrealistic future of what this new music distribution system would look like. And it just turned out that by creating that vision, you actually were able to make it happen. So that was something that really stuck with me.
Cool. Thank you. I'd forgotten all about that. That is a really big takeaway point. Yeah. Thank you. It's like when you make a business, this is your little chance to make like a perfect world. You know, in this circle, it's my rules. And I think the world should work like this. I think we shouldn't have privacy policies and user agreements and terms and conditions. And I don't think we should have, you know, weekly, daily meetings. And I don't think we should, you know, it's whatever it is. You could just set up your business as just like your own little utopia where things work the way that you think they should.
Yep, exactly. Well, I think that's an incredible place to end this interview, and it was really amazing talking with you today and hearing your perspective, and I think it's going to inspire a lot of people. So thanks so much.
Thanks, Amber. And good to see you again.
Yeah, you too. All right.